For the week of December 20th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 305, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How are y'all, Sperling?
Well, Michael, I really just have one question to ask you.
There has been an awakening. Have you felt it?
Have you felt it, Michael? Did you go see it?
You are the only person to make a Star Wars reference this week. Yes, I saw Star Wars. More importantly, I just arrived in Birmingham, Alabama for the holidays. I walk in the door and start podcasting the show because I love our listeners. Sperling, tell them how much you love them.
I love them a lot, but except there's not going to be any show next week because I'm traveling. And apparently you think that I don't love people. I love everybody. Well,
all right. So there's no show next week, unfortunately. That gives them a chance to catch up with all the earlier jam-packed shows that we've done throughout the year, or perhaps, you know, see their family and then go see Star Wars again, since apparently everybody saw it this weekend. And then we'll get on with our lives. We'll be back in the beginning of January, right?
Yes, but I know one person who did not see Star Wars, at least one, and her name is Amy Poehler. In fact, here's what she had to say about Star Wars.
I don't care. I don't care about Star Wars. I never... I'm tired of pretending. I don't care about it.
I think that's how they'll feel after we've gone over 10 hours of coverage of the box office. But there's no avoiding it, is there? We have to talk about Star Wars.
Well, that's true. We kind of do. As you know, that basically it's exactly what Bill Murray predicted back in 1977.
Oh God.
Star Wars. Nothing but Star Wars.
Come on.
Is that it, please?
You mean I can't.
No.
Wait, I got my new sign off. And it was President Obama who gave it to me.
I got to get to Star Wars.
Can you believe that? There he is ending a press conference and he's like, okay, I got to go see Star Wars.
Hillary Clinton said it in the debates.
Are you serious?
She said, may the force be with you.
Oh, you know what? You cannot market a movie that I mean, this is like marketing genius. This is unbelievable.
That's right. And if we wanted to market our show, of course, we would ask people to go onto iTunes and rate the show, right? It's the holiday season, so we're going to be gone next week. So whether you're celebrating Christmas or you celebrated Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or winter solstice, whatever it is, have a great time with your family. And if you want to give us a gift, go onto iTunes and rate the show, right?
Rate the show, review the show, subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Of course, you can then write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com, which is where you will find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for the page Showbiz Sandbox and up we should come.
Really, it would be a great gift. It would really end our year on a positive note if you rated the show. Just put in 5 stars or 4, if that's what you think. And if you put in a line of text, even better. And if you do it in another country other than North America, send us a screenshot because we cannot access those on our own. But they're accessing the show right now. They want to know what we're going to talk about. Sperling, tell them what's on this week's show.
Oh, I meant to play the Bill Murray clip again.
Keep going.
Okay, well, we're going to start with Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Maybe, just maybe, we'll find some new angle to take on one of the biggest box office hits of all time. Then again, maybe not. It's a slow week before Christmas, so there's not much going on other than the entire world heading to the movies to see Star Wars, including, did I just mention that President Obama said something about the thing?
Yes, okay.
Nonetheless, Michael and I will weigh in on the annual list of films added to the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. It always makes for a fascinating mix, and we'll discuss what made this year's cut and why. What were the films and why are they there? Hint, it's not always about artistry. It's not artistry that counts necessarily. And I'm not looking at you, Top Gun. We'll wind up in the music industry during Inside Baseball. It turns out online radio services such as Pandora will soon be paying more to license music. Meanwhile, Adele is trying to prevent her fans from having to pay more to purchase tickets to see her in concert, if one can actually do that, because I was not able to. We'll tell you about the growing backlash against the secondary market for concert tickets and what some artists are doing about it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the major entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And this week, we're doing it with music. Okay, seriously, I don't want to get sued.
Okay. So, obviously, box office records were made all over the world, but I want to focus first on North America, where for the first time in history, two Bollywood films opened up in the top 10 in the United States and Canada. Diwali at number 9 and Bajirao Mastani at number 10. This is, I think, fascinating and huge news. They both made just under $2 million. They also opened up in India and a number of parts all over the world. So a number of territories for both these movies. They're big box office behemoths going head-to-head in their own country and here in North America. And they scored in the top 10. That's kind of amazing. It's certainly one to remember. The first time in history that two Bollywood movies open in the top 10 in North America.
That is actually fascinating. I did not know that. And here I am. I went over the show notes and somehow that escaped me.
What one little detail that fascinated me, and we'll get to them when they're in the box office roundup. So, because they're in, of course, the top 10. I would point out, I love RentTrack. We get our information from RentTrack. We have a link to them in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profits and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, LA Times, you name it. However, those two movies that I just mentioned, which should have been on this list, were not on the list. I think there's, you know, RentTrack is only as good as the information people push to them, I believe. And I don't think there's strong reporting from the Indian market. That's my only explanation. I'm sure if they were given the info, they would include it. But these two movies were not in there, but I pieced together what looks like their box office totals worldwide. And so now I've readjusted the chart. So the original RentTrack chart did not include them, but I have put them in there because that's where they belong, because they made that much money. So we don't know what movies we miss around the world every once in a while. If it doesn't get reported to some of the big people here, it's not covered, it may fall through the cracks.
Well, and I agree. I mean, certainly with the whole Star Wars grosses in Japan, because I was a little thrown off that Star Wars, The Force Awakens, opened below Revenge of the Sith, Episode 3. So I thought, how could that possibly be? What with, ticket prices rising and everything? It just shocked me, but we'll explain why in a moment. And
all
so
right.
I did a lot of research and I realized, wow, we're not getting most of the numbers from Japan.
Well, there you go. So first we will cover the rest of the movies and then we'll come back to Star Wars. Obviously, that's the number one movie around the world. We've got the newest figures, which means it now is the biggest worldwide opening of all time at $528 million. It set records almost everywhere. And frankly, we're focusing in on where it didn't set records to find out why, because that's a little interesting. That's the number one movie, of course, $500 million and counting. Number two around the world is Mogen, The Lost Legend. This is a Chinese action fantasy. It grossed $85 million over the weekend in four territories. It cost $37 million to make, so it's off to a huge start. Of course, it opened in China, and it's a big month for Chinese movies, and this is why Star Wars didn't open in China.
That's
China
right.
Wanted to leave room open for its own movies, and so Star Wars opens in January 9th in China, right?
Yes. In fact, if you really look at it, a lot of people were shocked that, The Force Awakens couldn't, at first blush or first announcement, break Jurassic World, which opened earlier this year, opened to, what, $517 million or $520
million? Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so basically they were saying, oh, how come it couldn't beat Jurassic World? It should have beat that. Well, guess what? $99 million of Jurassic World's opening weekend box office, $99 million worth of tickets were sold in China. Okay, so without China, you're doing away with, even if you say half.
Right, but that's part of scheduling, right? If you chose to open in December, you know that means you're not going to necessarily open in every territory. Every country's different, and you can maximize your opening weekend, but is that the most important thing for your movie? Sometimes for a movie like this, it's important and it helps. But for most movies, you know, if you want to stay away from a weekend where there's a big movie in India, you open the weekend before or after. If you see a holiday that helps you, you move it up a week ahead of the U.S. in, you know, Japan or wherever it may be. So scheduling worldwide, you know, opening day all around the world is not necessarily the best way to maximize your profit. But when it's a monster franchise like this, of course, it can be.
Well, one of the biggest issues, especially in certain countries, is piracy. So if you
right,
open
you
up
want
first,
to get it out fast. Well, that's just why we see more and more worldwide releases in general, isn't it?
Well,
they get
that,
them out quicker.
Yeah, that and the fact that you can actually do it thanks to digital
prints.
Yeah.
So number two around the world is the Chinese film Mojin, The Lost Legend, $85 million. That's a big weekend. Number three around the world is another Chinese film. It's Surprise, Journey to the West. This is a comedy fantasy. It's another take on The Monkey King. It grossed $24 million, and it's made $34 million and counting. At number four is Sisters, the Tina Fey movie. They're like, thank you. Pay attention to us. It opened to $15 million, most of it in North America. It only cost $30 million to make. So it's off to a good start. That's what you call counter-programming.
Yes.
Right? I mean, what were the percentage of men? It varied depending on whether you spoke to the studio or some outside people. Some outside people, I think, said like 63% of the audience for Star Wars was male on
opening
week. That's
right, yeah.
But some, I think the studio claims like 54 or 57%.
Yeah, it's probably somewhere above 50%. You know that much.
Well, no, we know the studio said it was above 50%. Right. They said it was like 57%.
Okay.
So there's no question about that. But I think outside people say it's even more skewed to men. But it does have a female lead, Daisy Ridley, and she's like the protagonist. So that might help with good reviews and good buzz and the fact that there's a female lead that might bring in the women the second and third weekend. And number five around the world is more counter-programming. Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Road Chip. I think it's like part four, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Grossed $14.4 million over the weekend. It's pretty pricey, though. It costs $90 million to make. So this one really does need legs in the U.S. and around the world. And number six is The Hunger Games. Speaking of strong female leads, another $13 million. That's about to pass $600 million and counting. And number seven is a real disappointment, I think. I mean, I don't know how much is left here, but The Good Dinosaur, the Pixar film, another $13 million. It's struggling to get to $100 million in North America. It's almost dead, and I think it's probably going to be wiped out next week. It's going to get to $100 million, but just barely.
So are you saying wiped out because the dinosaurs were wiped? Okay.
Very good. Worldwide, it's at $190 million. It's in 49 territories, so it has territories to play out. We'll have to see where it ends up, but this looks like it will be the rare commercial and frankly almost critical flop as well. I mean, it was pretty coolly received. And number eight is another movie, another reason why Star Wars wasn't number one in every single country. It's The Himalayas. This is a South Korean action drama, and it beat Star Wars. It handily beat Star Wars, apparently. It grossed $8.5 million over the weekend, and apparently in Korea, Star Wars grossed less.
Yes.
Even despite getting sort of middling reviews, at least from the American trades. And number nine is Spectre, the James Bond film, $840 million worldwide. And number 10, what looks like another flop, In the Heart of the Sea, the Ron Howard film, it is falling hard and fast. And frankly, with Star Wars gobbling up audiences, I feel bad for any movie that was hoping to have legs right now. That grossed $7 million over the weekend. It's at $68 million and counting. Now we get to those two Bollywood movies that have gone head-to-head in their country and in North America and made history by debuting in the top 10 in North America. They are Dilwale, which is an action comedy romance musical. It grossed $6.6 million over the weekend worldwide. It cost $15 million to make. The other movie is, I played the pronunciation, I hope I get it,
Bajirao Mastani, yeah.
It's a Bollywood epic historical romance musical. It costs $18 million to make, a smidge more. It's made at least $5.8 million, but that does not include Sunday's grosses, at least in India. The information I found online only had Friday and Saturday grosses for India. So piecing that together with the North American and some other info, these are very rough estimates for these two movies, but they definitely belong to be in the top 20, top 10, top 15 of worldwide box office based on the information I do have. And one little detail that I found fascinating about Mastani, I'm going to just call it that, is that one news article that I linked to says that the movie sold its satellite rights. Remember, it cost $18 million. They sold the satellite rights for $7 million. Satellite rights in India, Spirelli, and I assume is like selling it to cable, right?
Yes, it is. And especially when you think about it, the infrastructure there is satellite driven.
Right. So that's a big part of it. The music rights, which I assume means the soundtrack, but perhaps
yes,
it also means karaoke and other spinoffs of music. I'm not sure what everything music rights entails, but that sold for $10 million. So that's your music rights. You know how intertwined the pop industry and the movie industry are in Bollywood and in India and those other territories. So obviously synergy is huge there. All the stars sing, the songs, the soundtracks to the movies, to the pop stars. But $10 million for the sound, that was the most valuable thing about the movie. More valuable than the movie itself.
And just think about it for a second. Think about the price of a movie ticket in India.
Yeah.
Being about $3 US.
Okay.
The movie made nearly $6 million.
Did terrifically well. The director of Bajirao Mastani was boasting about how it had built on Saturday from Friday. So it was getting great word of mouth. I think the other was doing well as well. The other one, the Dilwale, was seen as the bigger of the two in a sense. But I find it fascinating that you can sell off the soundtrack and the film rights for Satellite and make your budget back before you've even opened in the theaters.
Would you like me to play a clip from?
I would not.
Okay, just checking.
At number 13 is Krampus. You know what? Krampus, Creed, Bridge of Spies. Okay, here's something new to talk about. It's another film that opened up in South Korea. Perhaps that also helped keep Star Wars from being number one in that country. It is The Tiger, An Old Hunter's Tale. It's a South Korean drama, and it made just about $4 million on its opening weekend. All those other movies, they're, you know, doing this and that and the other thing around the world. Creed is about to pass $100 million and counting. But the big news, of course, is Star Wars. Yes, I saw it. Sperling, did you see it?
I did see it. I saw it in a Dolby Cinema HDR version of it, and it was stunning to look at. That laser projection, dual laser, it's unbelievable how rich the colors are.
How much were your tickets?
It's unbelievable how rich the colors are. Actually, I think they were only about $18.
Only.
Well, I mean, you know, in LA, so where right. Tickets are generally about $13 to $14 anyway.
Yeah, I paid $13.50, I believe, for my straight 2D showing of Star Wars. I saw it on Friday afternoon at 5:30. The theater was half empty. You could have strolled in. There was a line for the IMAX 3D. Obviously, IMAX 3D was where the hardcore geeks went. What I noticed was that film times were selling out for 2D faster than, you know, plain old 3D. 3D IMAX was a massive sellout, but the 3D was not doing quite as well as the 2D from what I could see, though there were more 3D screenings. But you could see 3D had tickets available and 2D was selling out all over the city come the evening time. So, you know, that's what you see. The majority of the tickets sold were in 2D. Which I guess would include yours, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, okay. So here's, this is a research by accident. That's what I wound up doing because I didn't buy tickets to see Star Wars. I went and, I did eventually, but I didn't buy them on October 19th when they were first.
No, I didn't. I bought them the day of. Yeah,
same here. And so I was like looking around and I was looking at all of the different movie theaters around me and seeing which ones had sold out and for what show times. And they were pretty much all sold out across the board everywhere. There were some seats up front in most theaters. So like the first row of many screenings, whether it was 2D or 3D, were all pretty much open. You could go and just walk up and sit in the front row. For some screenings, they were mostly sold out except for the sides. So like, you know, all, far to the left, far to the
especially
right.
Especially for 3D, I imagine.
Yes.
Because that's where you do not want to sit.
Right. And so I noticed that. Now, it just so happens that the AMC Century 15 opened up their what is called the Dolby Cinema at AMC Prime. They opened that screen up. It wasn't supposed to open until after Star Wars. They wound up racing to get it finished. And so they put tickets on sale Thursday night. And so I wound up getting tickets like, great seats, great showtime, just by chance. So while I was purchasing those tickets, the tickets that I was purchasing wound up selling to somebody else, and I had to sit next to those seats. That's how fast tickets were selling.
Right, but that's also a reflection of capacity.
Yes,
correct. I could go at 5, I could go in the middle of the day and decide at 3 o'clock, 3:30, I'm going to go to the, you know, 4:30 showing or whatever it was. No, I think I decided 4:30, I was going to go to 5:30. You know, I couldn't have picked 8 o'clock 3D or 2D prime time, but I could, you know, there was a lot of room and there were screenings available because they have so many seats. Even when you have a blockbuster like this, seating capacity was probably at like 60%, wasn't it?
I think
when you
look
at the whole
day, it was above 70% from what I heard.
Well, Avengers was at 60%.
Okay.
That's why I picked that number out because I thought that was pretty impressive. So pretty much every record was set by this movie. It's easier to talk about what records it didn't set, but I would like to focus on one record that it does hold, and that's the biggest opening weekend of all time in North America. $238 million on opening weekend, right?
Yes, it also, I think, is the only... What?
Wrong. No, it did not gross $238 million on its opening weekend.
Oh, you're going to...
Gross on its opening weekend?
What?
It grossed... $181 million, which is a ton of money. Why do we continue to include Thursday previews in the opening weekend grosses? It's ridiculous. It's stupid. Why not include Wednesday?
Well, as you can, we'll get to in a moment, you'll
see. Why not include Wednesday? There's no reason not to. If you're going to say weekend includes Thursday starting at 7 p.m. Now, if someone shows up at midnight and it's literally Friday and they're that crazy to see the movie, I say more power to you. And I understand why they open the movie on Thursday, but that's not the opening weekend number. It's just not. It's 4 days. It's not 3 days.
At the Chinese and at the Cinerama Dome over in Hollywood, those showings at 2 a.m., 5 a.m. were all sold out. I couldn't believe it. I thought for
sure. Well, I can't either since they had 7 p.m., 9 and 11 the day before.
Yeah, but I guess people wanted to see it in the Chinese theater. And
Yeah, that's a special fun place to see it. But again, you know, come on. This is ridiculous. It's now Thursday at 7 p.m. That is not a three-day weekend total.
Well, you know, and that was always when I was helping build software for cinema exhibition. That was always an issue because you'd sell the tickets, right? Advance tickets or even day of tickets. And the business date, okay, would be that Thursday. So in this case, December 17th would be the date of when the money was received. Right. However, it had to be paid out to the studios as if it were made on December 18th. So it was a programming nightmare to say, okay, well, it's the business date for this for the theater of the 17th and for the movie of the 18th.
How did you solve it?
Oh, I let programmers smarter than me do it, actually.
So, you know, again, there's 27 records it set. Any record you can think of, practically, it set. Here's another record it didn't set. Biggest Saturday of all time.
It didn't. So what was that?
Well, that is Jurassic World. That maintains the record for the biggest Saturday of all time. One, of course, it does have the biggest Sunday of all time. And so because, you know, there's just, it's a holiday weekend, I think there was more steady going to the movie every single day as opposed to like a typical summer day where you're going to see Saturday be front loaded.
Right. Well, and, you know, it made $120 million on Friday, which is the first time a movie's ever made more than $100 million in a single day in North America.
Which includes $57 million from Thursday.
Does it? I don't think so. I think it made $120 million on...
Starting at midnight?
Starting at midnight, yeah.
No, I think I did the math, because Saturday and Sunday, it's... What's the biggest Saturday?
I have no idea.
Or biggest Sunday. It just made the biggest Sunday.
I don't know. Too many records. Can't play them all.
Yeah, no, I believe that includes Thursday, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know.
No, it doesn't, because then it would be 157, and then you would get to... Saturday and Sunday is only...
You know, you can tell that we don't do math a lot around here at Showbiz Sandbox. But when we do...
Well, the numbers are confusing because they keep lying about what the numbers are. Oh, the biggest opening weekend, including Thursday. You know, it's like, biggest Friday. Well, does that include Thursday? Does that include midnight? What, you know, when is that starting from? And that's why I'm annoyed, that fact that we include Thursday figures in big opening weekend numbers. We should just take them all out. Subtract them all. If you go after midnight, fine. Before midnight, that's Thursday. That's fine. And you can have a Thursday record and a Wednesday record and a Tuesday record. But, you know, somebody's going to open their movie on Wednesday and convince them to include it in their opening weekend grosses. Why not?
Well, they actually have done that, and they do remove it for opening weekend. They go back to the three-day when it opens on Wednesday. But
why don't they do that for Thursday? I'm saying someone's going to convince them, just include it. Just pretend.
Yeah.
Seven. Why not Thursday at
this,
five?
This
why
is a problem. This is a problem, actually, and, you know, looking at the comments and some of these stories about how the movie did in Japan, okay, and I know we're going to get back to North America and Latin America, but the movie opened in Japan, right, and a lot of people said, oh, it didn't break the, you know, it didn't set the all-time attendance record or the all-time opening weekend record, so I thought that is rather odd that Revenge of the Sith, Episode 3 of Star Wars, should have opened higher than that. So I went and did a little...
It had competition, right?
Number one, it had competition. Okay, so you're right. A movie called Yo-Kai Watch opened this weekend, and it's a huge children's movie, and it's like the next Pokemon, everybody's saying. And
your kid's going to want Yo-Kai Watch come next Christmas.
And so I did the research to find out, is that true? And apparently, it is true. However... Here's the thing. In Japan, for some time up until 2012, they were including preview screenings, what they called preview screenings. That was both the midnight showings and screenings the weekend before. So when
weekend before.
Well, you know, like sneak previews, which we don't do in the U.S.
The weekend
anymore.
Before. They would include the grosses from a week earlier.
Right. And so now, after...
Why not?
Well, that's... They
Let's
stopped
make
doing
all records
it.
Meaningless.
They stopped doing it. But what that means is that all of a sudden you have
now harder.
It's much harder to break into the top 10 sure. of opening weekends. So Revenge of the Sith, I think, is number 5, and Harry Potter is number 1, and Jurassic World
well,
is number 1.
The numbers. It's very easy
actually,
to
Actually, no. You know what the number 1 movie opening of all time, if you count those preview screenings, is? The number 1 movie of all time is The Matrix Reloaded. That should tell you how skewed it is, and that's why they now look at these...
And they can go back and adjust.
And that's what they do. They call them aggregated numbers. However, what I will say, because a lot of people are knocking Japan or knocking Star Wars because of Japan here, here's
Who's knocking Star Wars because of Japan?
In the comment section.
What?
I'm just saying.
Don't repeat dumb comments by dumb people.
I don't know. They could be
smart
people.
Star Wars couldn't win in Japan. Whatever.
Here's the deal.
$500 million.
In Japan this weekend, Japan had the biggest box office weekend in the country's history, okay, because of these two movies. And
we had it in North America as well.
And yeah, so Star Wars, The Force Awakens, these are estimates now, okay? 1.45 billion yen, or about between $12 and $13 million, with an estimated 925,000 admissions, which is around 50 to 55% capacity. Okay.
That's too many numbers. You didn't need to tell the capacity.
Okay. Well, Yo-Kai Watch. Okay. This is
sold 1.1 million tickets.
Sold 1.1 million tickets for another 1.2 billion yen or $10 million. So here's the weird thing. Yo-Kai Watch had more people attend.
Kids.
And less money. Whereas,
kids.
Yeah. And Star
that's
Wars
why
made
when
more
you look
money.
At Finding Nemo and the numbers it made, and you think about kid ticket prices, how much more impressive it is. And that's why it would be awesome if we could rate movies by admissions rather than by dollar gross.
Correct.
Yes, but that's very cool. That's very interesting. Star Wars, another record it did not set. It is the second biggest all-time opening in Israeli history. It is not the biggest.
What was the
number one?
Schindler's List. I don't know.
No, the most recent Fast and Furious.
Oh,
the Force
okay.
is Strong with Paul Walker.
That was, I don't know why I said Schindler's List. I just assumed that everybody in Israel saw Schindler's List.
I'm sure they did. It was number 3 in Spain, the third biggest opening of all time. And I don't know what's first and second.
Couldn't find that either.
It was number 3 in Brazil. Hey, if you're in Chile, Brazil, Spain, let us know. What blocked Star Wars from being number 1 of all time?
Yeah, blocked us? What are you, a part of the movie now?
That's right. Here's the hype I didn't like. And this was when... This is now a little dated, but Brooke Barnes in the New York Times said about Star Wars' opening weekend, in an astounding display of cultural and commercial domination on a global scale, one with little precedent in the 100-year history of Hollywood, the Walt Disney Company's Star Wars The Force Awakens earned roughly $517 million in ticket sales worldwide, smashing multiple records even after accounting for inflation. That was before they had to readjust the numbers, to which I thought, yes, there's little precedent except a few months ago when Jurassic World had an even bigger opening.
Well, that's why he said little precedent, not no precedent.
But that's stupid. He makes it sound like it was like weeks ago that another movie had a bigger opening.
Well,
and
I also don't like
this sound like it's the end times.
I also don't like, you know, look, when Gone with the Wind opened, and that was a much anticipated opening.
Oh,
okay,
that's a monster. Don't even.
Yeah.
Star Wars isn't going to come with 100 miles of Gone with the Wind's admissions.
So, I mean, when you look at and I mean opening weekend, OK, or the opening, the
opening weekend doesn't apply to Gone with the Wind.
Exactly. Because of the way it opened and that it was a roadshow.
Right,
and...
it's a new world with these massive screens that we have. Of course, that's why. But it is good to put Star Wars in context as yet another marker in it's a long history of these blockbuster, mostly comic book movies setting these records. You look at Batman, and this is what Box Office Profits did. They said, hey, this is a huge day. It's a new marker. It's a new line in the sand that some other movie will cross probably sooner than we expect. You know, but my God, this is like 1989 when Batman opened to $40.5 million. That was a monster. That was the biggest opening of all time. By the way, Batman has every new Batman for a while set the opening record of all time. So I don't know what Batman versus Superman will do. They say, look at 2002 Spider-Man. It debuted to $114 million. It sort of rewrote the record books. And now that's happened again with Star Wars. Absolutely. But it's part of a continuum, and it's part of technology and part of just a bigger box office and more screens.
Well, and how much do you think they spent to market Force Awakens?
I have no idea. A gazillion? I mean, a lot of it, of course, is in kind, right?
Well, yeah, there's the rub. The studio itself is out of pocket maybe $25 million for TVN.
No.
And maybe another
$25 million? No way. Worldwide?
No, sorry.
That's it?
No, I only have numbers for North America, so I apologize.
Oh, okay.
I only have numbers for North America.
Okay, so they spent $25 million in North America? That's
just on
TVN. Crazy low.
Yeah, it is really low. Now, here's the thing, and I talked to somebody at Disney who, unfortunately, I wanted them to join us and tell us all about it, but they were like, yeah, I like my job, actually, so no. And they were saying, look, you know, they spend about $30 million in roughly to market an Avengers movie, which is a little lower than they would have spent on Ant-Man because nobody knew Ant-Man, okay?
Right.
And they're spending about roughly $25 million to fully market Force Awakens opening. However, as you mentioned, Michael, and there's a great article in Ad Age and the Wall Street Journal on this, there's about $66 million in co-branded marketing. So Verizon commercials, a mobile phone company here in the U.S., advertising Star Wars in their own ads. And you know what else? Campbell's, Kraft, General Mills, Subway, Dodge, all these car commercials. I mean, there's just so much in-kind services. So yeah, $66 million worth of advertising.
Wow. Is Ad Age owned by Wall Street Journal?
I think Ad Age is owned by, it's owned by the Prometheus Group, if I'm not mistaken.
All right. France, it was the second biggest opening weekend in history.
It was also the widest opening ever in that country.
Well,
I think over 1,000 screens.
Belgium, the second biggest opening. So again, perhaps France is still repercussions from the terrorist attack. Maybe people just aren't flocking to the theaters, or was there competition? If you're in France or Belgium, let us know.
So here's a question, Michael. You know, you'd think that all of this money flowing into Disney at this point would mean that shares of the company, you know, Disney, a publicly traded company, would just skyrocket.
Well, you know, stupidly, that is what you expect sometimes, because there was a lot of years when I would look and see a movie would open and then a studio stock would go up, even though you knew in advance that the movie was going to be big, and then it would go up. I'm like, who's the moron that is reacting to the opening weekend gross of one movie, A, and do they really think that's going to have a long-term impact on the studio? And B, why didn't they know in advance? And now you see that the studio stock price often reflects what they anticipate for a movie's opening. But again, even reacting to one movie seems silly unless it's Star Wars.
Right. Well,
they spent $4 billion for the movie, and they're looking at this investment and saying, you know what? This movie, you know, it opened to $500 million. It is probably reasonable to anticipate it will be the third film of all time to cross $2 billion. That's very, very likely. That's very possible. People love it. I didn't love it. I thought it was, you know, not nearly as bad as the prequels, but not nearly as good as the originals. But I don't want to spoil anyone's fun. I won't explain why. But it's certainly watchable, and it's certainly commercial. And so, you know, $1.8 billion, they're going to make well over $1.5 billion from this movie. And merchandise, they anticipate making $3 to $5 billion within the next year alone, which doesn't even include the merchandise they've sold in anticipation of the movie opening up. So with just one movie, they have made 50% more, probably, than the $4 billion they spent to buy the entire company.
You know, I was actually going to try and do a bit with you for this week's show where we talked about Star Wars, but bleeped out every other, like, you know, can you believe they bleep? And then they went to the planet bleep, you know, because all of the reviews of this movie, like, I think 20 years from now, we're going to look back and say, well, that review didn't say anything about the movie.
Because they're afraid to give anything away.
Yeah. I mean, it's gotten so, and I get it. I totally get it. Having seen the movie now, there are certain things you do not want ruined. I think it's actually the marketing, the narrative marketing for this movie, it was, in hindsight, incredible that nothing leaked out. And I have to, you know, look, we could talk about whether we liked the movie or didn't like the movie. Like you, Michael, I think we talked about it via text. You know, the movie has its narrative issues.
But, it's not good.
But, well, I'm not going to go so far as to say it's not good.
It's not good. You think it's good? How many stars out of 4 would you give it? I'd give it 2.
Maybe 2.5, 3.
2.5. Well, that's not good.
Maybe
2.5
3.
Isn't good. 2.5 is meh.
You know what? I would go so far as to say 3.
That's because you have children.
They haven't seen it yet, actually. But anyway, we were talking actually about the share price. It went down. The share price of Disney.
But not because of the movie.
No, because of ESPN and the company's cable business, people are beginning to realize, oh, wait a second, they're losing subscribers. They might actually, you know, lose money on that. And they might make money on this whole Star Wars thing, but they're going to lose money in cable. Whether that's true or not remains to be seen. But people like Richard Greenfield, an analyst at BTIG, a Wall Street analyst who's quite well known, he downgraded the stock to a sell. So after that happened, on Friday, they're making money at the box office and losing money on Wall Street.
Modestly, it went down like 2%.
3%.
But nonetheless, yeah. I would say anybody who talks up a stock because of a single movie opening, talks it up or down, that's not investing. That's just gambling. You're trying to you're longing it. You're trying to do something clever and make money, you know, today and sell it tomorrow. That's not investing. That's just nonsense.
Are you trying to tell me that Wall Street is a form of gambling?
I am.
Okay, well, you know. Hey, I thought you'd be interested, though, Michael. I got all of these figures for you because I knew you'd ask me. And so for once, I actually got the figures ahead of time.
Oh, the 2D, 3D, all that
stuff? You always ask me, and I'm always like,
okay, let's wrap it up with that, then. Let's wrap up our Star Wars discussion with a breakdown of who saw what.
And then we'll mention all the spoilers in one go.
Yes.
Okay. So 2D, 53% saw it in 2D.
This is gross.
Gross is correct.
This is not ticket sales. That means 2D ticket sales were, in fact, more like higher, 57-58%, if not 60.
I don't know, maybe.
They have to be, because the ticket prices cost a lot more for 3D and 3D premium.
Well,
they have to be. That means if it's gross, that means it's inevitably points higher.
47% of the gross was in, of course, 3D, and of that...
And premium.
28% was traditional 3D, 12% was IMAX, okay? 7% was 3D in these premium large formats, which are not IMAX,
right,
but are like, you know, homegrown.
I wonder
brands.
How many were real IMAX.
391 sites, $30 million worth of IMAX tickets sold.
There are not 391 real IMAX sites.
That's how many sites
are branded IMAX.
That are branded IMAX in which the movie played around the world. So domestically, it made $30 million in IMAX.
Right. I wonder, have you seen anybody reviewing, talking about whether the 3D is worth it or whether the IMAX, I'm sure they thought it looked cool, but you know what I mean?
Well, I only saw J.J. Abrams talk about it. And what he said was, you know, he was the first to say, I am not an aficionado of 3D or an advocate for 3D at all. And I was really surprised at seeing the film in 3D, that it did change my perspective on certain aspects of certain scenes. But he qualified that by saying, I saw it in a laser, you know, laser projection, dual
right,
laser projection.
As bright as possible.
Yeah, and passive glasses. So he said, if you can see it that way, it really is worth seeing in 3D in that setting.
Well, my new rule is a very simple one. Rather than going into 3D versus 2D, if the premiere is not in 3D, don't bother.
Well, I hate to tell you
when
this.
When they show it to the critics in 2D, which is what the critics here in New York saw it, and it was 2D, don't bother.
Well, I found out...
If the critics aren't asked to see it in 3D, then don't bother. Because if they don't demand the critics see it in 3D, because that's the best way. When they had Avatar, you saw it in 3D. When they had Mission Impossible, they showed it to the critics in IMAX, because there were 40 minutes or whatever in IMAX, you know, or the Batman movie. When it's important, they will make sure the critics see it in the best way possible. And if the critics don't see it in 3D, it's not worth your time.
Well, I would go more on the critics than the premiere, and here's why. The premiere had like 7,000 attendees, and I'm not exaggerating. They did it at the Dolby Theater where the Oscars are held, so there's like 3,500 seats right there. And I asked why they didn't do it in 3D, because, you know, Dolby has 3D technology. And somebody from Dolby said, well, because we couldn't get enough glasses, and we knew we wouldn't get half of them back, because they would all want to keep it as a souvenir, so we decided... No, just show the 2D version. Like, you know, Disney didn't want to like foot the bill on that.
That's a nice lie. That's a nice lie, because almost no premieres are in 3D, because people, the celebrities and the people do not want to put on the glasses. Unless it's an important movie, it doesn't happen that way.
Not anymore.
It's very rare that they show a premiere in 3D. I can't remember the last one where they did. All right. Well, we know that Star Wars, we're done. Star Wars is on the National Film Registry. It's one of the...
You mean the original, not this one.
The original, yes, Star Wars, of course. This Star Wars is Star Wars. It's not Star Wars Episode 4 or New Hope. It's called Star Wars. It was made in 1977 and entered the National Film Registry in 1989 because it's a landmark work. Sometimes that means it's important artistically, but not necessarily. It just means it's a landmark work. So there are movies, there are shorts, there are documentaries. There's old Tom Edison footage shot when the early days of kinetoscope. So there's all sorts of things make the National Film Registry. And the new list is just out, isn't it?
Yes. So what were the films? I mean, do you want to go down every single film?
No,
I don't think so.
No, we've got a list in our show notes. It's interesting. The movies that people recognize are Being There, Peter Sellers' final film, which is a great movie. Ghostbusters, which my brother was thrilled by. He's seen Ghostbusters like every week since he was, since it came out. L.A. Confidential, that's a big movie. Seconds, the John Frankenheimer film with Rock Hudson. And the big one, I think, for two big ones for people who are middle America are The Shawshank Redemption, which people absolutely love.
That's
people
true. Yeah.
Love Shawshank Redemption. They are great. To Americans, this is like the Citizen Kane of movies. They just think this movie is the cat's meow. And also on the list is Top Gun.
Well, I don't even know what to say about that. I don't know why that movie made the list.
Well, I think it was, what's his name who did Batman?
Top Gun?
Batman. The recent trilogy.
Christopher Nolan?
Yeah, Christopher Nolan. I think he talked about how Top Gun influenced him. The way it was cut, the way it was shot, the way it's made, the production of it. Tarantino has a very funny riff in one movie about Top Gun, but he's obsessed with the movie. I think it's obviously a cultural touchstone. There's a lot of stuff that came out of that movie. It made Tom Cruise a star to the ninth degree. He was obviously on his way there with Risky Business, but Top Gun sent him into the stratosphere, and he's one of the biggest stars of the last 30 years. So there are a lot of reasons why that movie's on the list. It's not necessarily that it was a well-reviewed film. It wasn't particularly. But there are people who speak up for its qualities in editing and the look and the way it was put together and the way it was marketed and made. So, Top Gun does have its adherents.
Well, and that's why Christopher Nolan, when he set out to make Batman, he wanted Kenny Loggins to do the theme song. But Kenny said no.
And one other big movie that people would know is Winchester 73. They won't know, but Jimmy Stewart, great Western, one of my favorites of his Westerns. No, my favorite Jimmy Stewart Western, I think. I love that movie. I've seen it many times. It's just a very fun movie where you follow a rifle around the Old West from one person to another. It's sort of an old trick, but they do it really, really well. And there's lots of weird smaller movies on it, things you haven't heard of, documentaries, animated shorts. One in particular I think is very cool, and that's Dracula. Dracula is now on the list.
Well, the Spanish language edition.
That's right. It's from 1931. And of course, the original Dracula, I believe, is on the list too, though I should check. I don't actually know that. But this is from an era when they would shoot two versions of a movie at the same time. Sometimes when they were transitioning from silent to sound, they would do that. Other times they would shoot a different edition for a different market in a different language. So they'd have an English language and they would reuse the sets for a Spanish language version. Sometimes it was the same actors, especially if they spoke both languages, of course. Other times it was a whole new cast and crew even. It wasn't, all they did was they reused the sets. So in the case of Dracula, they shot the English language version during the day. And very famously, they shot the Spanish language version at night, which is kind of creepy and appropriate for Dracula. And it's 20 minutes longer. It was directed by the man who did Valentino's The Sheik. And it's, by many accounts, a better movie. It's been often acclaimed as a better film than the original Dracula, the Spanish language version being superior. And now here it is enshrined in the National Film Registry.
Well, and Antonio Banderas was ecstatic when he heard that The Mark of Zorro made it into the National Film Registry. And that was until somebody told him, no, The Mark of Zorro, the 1920 version with Douglas Fairbanks, not
yes,
your version.
That.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so there's lots of cool stuff. We've got the list there. It's always a big deal when this list comes out because there's a lot of fun to talk about.
Okay, so the National Film Registry is a big deal. Then
yes.
It must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Star Wars. No, just kidding. come on, that was good timing, no?
That was pretty good.
Howard Stern is staying put at SiriusXM. He may have ended his time on the TV show America's Got Talent. He may have flirted with doing a standalone app. But Stern is remaining with Sirius in a new 5-year pact that includes giving the company the rights to make use of audio and video from Stern's 30-year career via new distribution outlets such as, a mobile app. Video is a key component in the new deal, though details are sketchy, so are the dollar figures tied to the new contract? We don't know how much it's going to cost. Stern's last deal was worth $80 million a year. The stock for SiriusXM rose on the news. Big deal or big whoop?
In this case, it's appropriate that they would rise since he is such a key player for Sirius XM. I think it's a very big deal because, I mean, this is a big deal for satellite radio, right? It used to be an industry. Now it's down to one company, and they've got a lot of competition with Spotify and Pandora and Apple Radio and people's phones plugging into a car. It's really hard for them to keep their heads up.
I'm surprised they're still in business, to be honest.
I know. Well, Stern is a reason. You know what? I didn't know this. 3/4 of every car is prefixed with satellite radio and the chance to subscribe to it. And they give you a month free. So the car
actually they give you 6 months free with the purchase of your car.
6 months,
and that is one of their biggest drivers of subscribers. So when the economy is bad and fewer cars are selling, you'll notice that Sirius XM's subscriber rates begin to plateau or dip, and that's the reason.
Well, and I'm off of my figures. It's 7 out of every 10 new cars. So 70% of all new cars come loaded with Sirius XM and a free 6-month trial. So obviously car manufacturers get money back from that. So that's important to them. Sirius has that way to get to new people. And Howard Stern is why people tune in the first place. It's significant for apps, of course. You know, that's just a new revenue stream and a new world where a lot of things are migrating to. And I really think it's significant for Apple Radio, Netflix, Amazon, and whomever else was trying to lure Howard Stern away, because they failed to land him.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know how... Well,
somebody must have been talking to him, right?
Yeah, I don't know how... I don't know what his listen. He's got loyal listeners, without a doubt. But,
He's getting $80 million a year. He's making the money.
I think he's bigger on the East Coast than he is on the West Coast.
I'm sure he is.
Okay. Well, it's official, Michael. There's too much damn TV to watch. Sure, almost 1,000 movies got released in New York City in 2015, but most of them are 2 hours or less. On TV, new research from FX says there were 409 scripted shows on TV, pay, basic cable, and OTT over the top. That's just scripted TV. It doesn't count competition shows like The Voice, news, reality TV, and so on. And each one of those shows usually has at least 6 episodes, often 10 or 12, and up to 22 or more. It's literally too much for any one person to watch. That's why, Michael, I'm going to ask if you could just summarize all of them for me. I'll read that. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It is a lot of television. Is there enough talent to go around? Is there enough audience to go around? I think the number's going to have to go down a little bit. When critics are overwhelmed, people whose job is to watch television shows, and they're like, oh my God, there's too much. Something's going to give, unless all these niche audiences are being served and everybody's happy. But I can't see how 400 shows a year can make money.
I do find it interesting that FX should do this research, okay? FX being a cable network that is not usually in the position to do market
research. Yeah, well, they want the info, and they've made that sort of one of their calling cards, haven't they?
Well, yeah, John Landgraf, the head of FX, said during the TCA's, the television critics meetings in the summer, that there's just too much TV. There's over 400 scripted shows, and everybody said, oh, no, that can't be true. So he went off and did his research and came back and said, yeah, you're right, it isn't true. It's 409 shows.
Well, in fact, he said it would soon be 400 shows, and in fact, it already is 400 shows, so he's even more right than he thought.
Yes, and he's going to do the research to prove it. Okay, so Hasbro and Paramount, they're creating a movie universe from G.I. Joe. Yay! Just what we wanted, another movie universe. A movie universe, of course, is a franchise built around not just one character, but a string of characters all interconnected. Instead of Superman movies, you get the Justice League, with movies starring Wonder Woman and Superman and Aquaman, and then they'll all get together and do something. Think Star Wars or the Avengers. Now Paramount and Hasbro are getting in on that act by launching a new movie universe built around G.I. Joe, Micronauts, Visionaries, MASC, which stands for Mobile Army Strike Command, or it also stands for something I've never heard of before, and ROM, something else I've never heard of before. It's the natural decision after making 2 G.I. Joe movies that no one really remembers all that fondly. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a big whoop. You know, until they make a movie that's good that people like. I mean, the second G.I. Joe movie made more than the first, so fair enough. Maybe it goosed toy sales. Maybe that's what's driving this because, you know, obviously I don't know I know Micronauts, but I don't know MASC, Visionaries, or ROM because I'm not a little kid, I guess. But, you know, make one good movie, then worry about the universe. You know, I think they're getting too ambitious too soon. Everybody's doing it, and it's just getting exhausting when you think, oh my God, there's another 10 Star Wars movies coming.
Right. Well, again, you know, I know MASC and ROM. I just don't know the stories behind it. I know the little toy, you know, that
you
see.
There you go.
Yeah. Michael Jackson's Thriller album, and no, you did not just go into a time warp, but Michael Jackson's Thriller album set another record last week. It became the first album in history to be certified 30 times platinum in North America.
Why were people buying Thriller on their way to see Star Wars?
I have absolutely no idea. Okay. Well, that comes on the 33rd anniversary of the album's release in 1982. The term platinum, by the way, means different things in different eras and even in different countries. In this case, according to the RIAA, it means Thriller has sold 30 million copies in one format or another, or as Adele likes to call it, Saturday. If you're wondering,
not yet, Adele.
Yeah, if you're wondering, the Eagles are right behind Michael Jackson with 29 million copies sold of their first greatest hit set, followed by Led Zeppelin 4 with 23 million copies and AC/DC's Back in Black with 22 million copies worldwide. Billboard says Thriller has sold more than 100 million copies. Big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's still selling albums. It's still setting records. It's amazing. By the way, there are 100 million copies worldwide is a figure that they don't really have any source for. Michael Jackson just started saying that at one point, and then people started repeating it as if it was true. But worldwide figures are really hard to come by, so we just really don't know. Wikipedia, using a couple different metrics, looking at sales charts and confirmed sales like this system that we have in North America. They have it in the UK and France and all in a lot of countries. They confirm 68 million copies sold worldwide, and Pink Floyd is at 44 million copies. So they say Thriller sold 68 million copies confirmed. Certainly with bootlegs, I'm sure there were 100 million copies floating around the world at one point or another. But, you know, these figures are really nebulous, and just throwing it out there as if it's a given is just not right.
And that's what we're going to start doing about our listenership. Going to say we have 100
million listeners around the world.
But maybe we have to do it in the Michael Jackson voice. We have 20 million listeners. No?
maybe if Michael Jackson says it, people might listen.
Well, that would be news.
Definitely listen, yes, of course. If Adele says it, people might listen.
Well, this doesn't happen every day, Michael. Broadway is getting a new theater. The classic Hudson Theater opened in 1903 in New York City, boasting the biggest lobby in town. But it's been a conference center for many years. That's changing with a $10 million renovation that will honor the space's landmark status, making it a working theater again, and it's going to bring the total number of Broadway houses to 41. The Hudson is scheduled to open in the 2016-2017 season, which means 18 months from now at the earliest. No word on a first occupant, but with 900 seats, it's a smaller, kind of more of a play-friendly venue. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal because it doesn't happen every year or every decade practically. Broadway getting a new house. It is a very big deal. I should say that's 18 months at the latest. I messed that up. So it will open by mid-2017 at the absolute latest. Right now, there are about 15 Broadway houses that are locked up. You know, they've got Hamilton, they've got Book of Mormon, they've got Aladdin, they've got Lion King and Wicked, and they're not going anywhere. So there are 15 houses that are just off the book. So there's only really 26, 25 houses that are available, and some of those have hits that could play for a year or two. So the number of houses available is really, really important, and it's really great to have a play house available because it's a smaller house. And guess what? We know what will go in this theater eventually. Mark my words, it will be
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, because the company that owns this is doing Harry Potter in London. So the Ambassador Theatre Group is huge in the UK, and they've just moving really into North America. They own the Lyric, and now they own the Hudson, and they're renovating it. And so 900 seats sounds just about perfect for a play like Harry Potter.
Well, okay, you know, it just goes to show you how important Broadway is becoming as kind of a launching platform for live theater. That said, and I know it's always been, but now it's really becoming less regional and less North America than worldwide. And what I mean by that is, look at George Takei. He tried to bring something to Broadway. He succeeded, but he said the hardest part of bringing his musical to Broadway was finding a theater. He said it was really difficult. He did not think it would happen in his lifetime, and that speaks more to his age, he said, than the play itself or the musical itself. Now, speaking of theaters, movie buffs were in for a treat at the historic Cinerama Dome in L.A. One week, they were going to see the new Star Wars. The next week, they'd see the new Tarantino movie, Hateful Eight, in glorious Cinerama. Heck, the Cinerama logo is even in the movie's opening credits. Here's the problem. The theaters that were showing Star Wars had to guarantee to show that film for 4 weeks. It's called a minimum play time. That's hardly an arm-twisting demand when any theater hopes the movie will run longer, especially when they are certain to rake in the big bucks in its first 4 weeks. Tarantino cried foul, and he did so on The Howard Stern Show, in fact. However, Disney had the Cinerama booked months ago. Indeed, advanced tickets went on sale for Star Wars in October, and in a crowded holiday season, no one would want to see their film bumped after just 1 week. So Tarantino is out of luck. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm a bit confused because I was brought to my attention by Aaron, who, of course, is in L.A. like you are. What happened here? How could Tarantino, because, you know, he told me, oh, the Disney big-footed, the Hateful Eight. And then when I looked into it, it seemed like, well, no, they could never have. But they put ticket sales for the Star Wars movie on sale in October. So they knew long in advance that this movie was not. I don't understand how this confusion happened. Like Cinerama wanted to dump the movie and put in Hateful Eight for a week? Or what was going on here? Do you know?
Okay, now, well, this kind of deserved its own feature in a way, because if what Tarantino alleges is true, that Disney turned to Pacific Theaters and said, if you don't keep Star Wars in the Cinerama Dome for 2 weeks or more, if you don't play through the holidays, we won't give you that film for any of your other theaters. That is called block booking, which is against the law. So they couldn't really do that, much like they couldn't say, if you don't play Star Wars, then we're not going to give you some other movie.
But they wouldn't book it in the Cinerama Dome for 1 week.
Now, sometimes
nobody would.
Sometimes they do. However,
really,
but yes,
wouldn't it have to have been decided in October?
It would have been decided in October. Correct. Yes.
So why would Tarantino be finding about it now?
Because he's busy making a movie and doing other stuff and not paying attention to stuff like this. I don't know why he didn't. I mean, given the fact that he said he made this movie.
So it could be seen in the dome. That really sucks. I mean, it would be awesome, obviously, as a movie buff, if you could, you know, pull it for a week, show that movie for a week, then go back to Star Wars or whatever. And I think they were like, screw you, Disney. What do you care? You're going to make a gazillion dollars. Don't be mean to Hateful Eight. But I mean, I don't know. If I book my movie for the Cinerama Dome, you know, for December 18th, I'm not expecting it to be bumped September 25. I'm not in the business of, you know, being nice to art house people.
Well, and the Cinerama Dome, okay, Cinerama itself is a format. Of how films are shot and then shown, okay? It required more than one projector aimed at different parts of the screen, so you'd have to line up the visuals, and one projector would show one side of the film, the other projector would show the other. It's fascinating technology, and Tarantino wanted to shoot that way. In fact, he shot 65 millimeter, which then becomes 70 millimeter with sound, and the Cinerama Dome is one of the few standing theaters that can show 70 millimeter film out of the box. They don't have to.
Another is Champaign-Urbana in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, where Roger Ebert had his Ebert Fest, and it continues to this day. So that venue is probably showing Hateful Eight.
That's right. On film. Okay.
Right. On film. Yeah.
And that's the way Tarantino wanted the film to be seen and shown. And that's.
But in fact, the dome was upgraded to prepare for Star Wars, wasn't it?
That's right. Now, of
course.
Get
all geeky on me. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, they kept the 70 millimeter projectors there. They kept the 35 there. But what they did do was they took two Christie 6P laser projectors and Dolby 3D. So they basically did exactly what was done at these prime cinemas for HDR, high dynamic range, and they're blasting a very bright, large image onto the Cinerama Dome screen, which is curved, so it curves around the audience, for a bright 3D presentation, and they did that in advance of Star Wars. So it is probably, by the way, the best way to see Star Wars in 3D is in that
but
theater.
It's practically, but it is being shown in 70 millimeter in LA, right? I know it's playing at Lincoln Square and a couple other places here in New York in 70 millimeter.
I honestly do not know where they could possibly show this film in LA in 70 millimeter other than the Academy theater at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater at the Academy. I don't know where else. I'm sure there's a place that they can play it. I don't know where.
Oh, well, they have the list, you know.
You know, first of all, it costs a fortune to make one of these prints, you know.
So in LA, it's showing at the movies at Cinemark 18.
That makes sense.
And the Landmark.
And
in Hollywood, it's showing at the ArcLight Hollywood.
How is that even possible? They must be moving
in Burbank. It's playing at the AMC Burbank.
Okay, so they're basically turning IMAX screens into 70 millimeter screens. That's what they're doing, because it's the only way to get a screen big enough to do it.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, that makes sense.
So is it a big deal? It will become a big deal if Tarantino doesn't realize that what he's mentioning is that Disney is kind of possibly breaking a law.
Well, it will be a big law. Yeah.
Yeah. A big law or a big deal?
It'll be a big deal.
Okay, well, hallelujah, Michael. Fox has live musicals of Grease and Rocky Horror in the works, and now its newest announcement, the network has a trinity of specials on tap. It's working with Tyler Perry to create a live TV production of The Passion, a gospel and pop-infused musical that will air, guess when? On Palm Sunday, yeah, yep. 2016. The special will take place on location in New Orleans on March 20th and culminate in a procession from the Superdome to the banks of the Mississippi. And that, in my opinion, is the big deal here. Big deal or big whoop?
I was going to say Easter Sunday, but they're doing it on Palm Sunday because that's when The Passion took place, you know. So that's interesting. It's not when it, you know, Palm Sunday is not when it took place, but, you know,
yeah,
that's interesting. It's a week in advance. I guess they think people will be, you know, because you always had that Wizard of Oz on Easter Sunday. So that was sort of a holiday tradition. And they're doing this the week before because I guess people are distracted. I think it's a big deal. And I think TV is just like music. We have gone back to the future. You know, TV began with live events and that's where it is like totally living now. You know, you want a big network, you want to get attention, you want sports, you want a live event, you want something special and unique they got to see right now, whether it's the Republican debates or Grease Live. That's just where the action is.
Or maybe you could like throw a Miss Universe pageant and then get like Steve Harvey to.
He's a fine talent who made one mistake.
Yeah, no, I do not knock Steve Harvey for that.
I mean, fine talent. I'm just saying it's a mistake. Big deal.
Yeah. Okay. And should we tell people what may, who?
No.
May, no. Okay. All right. Well. I'm gonna
skip. In Colombia, they know.
that is for sure. Yeah. If you don't know, Google
yeah,
it.
Shoot.
Okay, so now Cheap Trick gets some love from its peers. The long-running band is entering the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame along with fellow inductees Chicago, Deep Purple, Steve Miller, and NWA. Yes, the trailblazing hip-hop band caps off a memorable year that included the highest-grossing movie musical of all time in North America and Oscar talk with getting named to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Can you believe that? What a year for those guys. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Great for all of them. Congratulations. I am stunned that the Smiths did not get in on the first ballot.
I am stunned about that as well. I guess also they figured, you know, they needed something for next year.
Maybe they read his novel.
Ugh, yeah.
They also a Nine Inch Nails, Chic, and Yes. You know, the Smiths in particular, I'm surprised.
So are you saying that the Academy, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I should say, not the Academy, that they said no to Yes?
That's right.
Ooh, okay. Okay, so we got, well, let's go to, you want to do the Broadway, Wins Fair Use or BMG? Which one?
Let's do BMG.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think about the time. You know, we're already running long. Thank you, Star Wars. Okay, so are internet service providers responsible for theft done on their networks? In a new closely watched court case, they may be responsible for not offering a reasonable repeat infringer policy. The music publisher BMG sued when it found Cox was less than helpful in sending quote-unquote demand letters to what they determined were individual pirates, presumably people downloading illegal material. The judge's pretrial rulings and the impact of the case mean it was certain to be appealed regardless of the verdict. It's unclear if BMG was being too broad-based in its demand letters or whether Cox was willfully indifferent to the theft occurring. Clearly, however, BMG was targeting end users rather than those posting the material. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It just seems a bizarre precedent that, you know, you have phone lines and you're responsible for what people say and do on them.
Well, I think they're responsible for when you find out as a phone company, and I'm just going to use your analogy there, that, hey, John Doe is planning a bank robbery. Could you please cut off his phone line?
But we know that the studios have been abusing this system dramatically, as I assume the record labels have been too, and the publishers. They've just been sending out a gazillion cease and desist letters to people that don't deserve to get them or they don't even know did them. They don't even know who's doing it necessarily, because just because you're on someone's, you know, internet protocol doesn't mean it's you. You know, I mean, it's just, it's been a boondoggle of like massive paperwork and massive just send something to everybody, you know? So I'm assuming that's the case here as well.
And I'm sure that's
that
why Cox
not targeted.
Was like, you know what? Enough.
They're not targeting people who say, oh, this person is downloading, you know, 20 terabytes an hour of stuff. Clearly this person needs to be dealt with. They're just saying, you see anything anywhere, send out a letter.
I'd be interested in reading this ruling. I'd love to know how this came down.
Okay.
That would be a big deal if I could actually find it.
It'll be a big deal when it gets appealed and we see where it ends up.
That's true. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
And it was a massively complicated story, but you are going to condense it down into one easy phrase.
Okay, how about this? I will condense all of our inside baseball topics into like maybe a sentence. You're going to pay more for your streaming music, and you're not going to be able to see Adele. Those are the two things that...
well, and one of those is not true.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know which one of them is true. The bottom line, so the Copyright Royalty Board here in the U.S. ruled...
So what was going on? Why was something in front of the Copyright Royalty Board? What happened? Did somebody sue or make a motion, or was it just an annual review? Do we know?
It's the five-year review. Okay. And that was up. And streaming services like Pandora, okay, they're called pure play services. They're like radio. You can't pick what they play. They play it for you, and then, you know, they stream under a compulsory license. So every 100 plays, they were paying 14 cents for every 100 plays, okay, of a
song.
They
were paying a royalty rate of 14 cents, whereas terrestrial radio was paying a royalty rate of 25 cents. Right? What were they paying?
No, they were paying, I believe, the same amount. I don't know. I have to double check that. But they were paying a little less than terrestrial radio. Not by much.
Because terrestrial radio has a limited reach, whereas online reaches everybody in the world.
Correct.
Right.
Now, and there's certain, that's why they call it a compulsory license. But for years, the reason that this was 14 cents for, you know, pure play internet radio services is that it was meant to, that lower fee was meant to kind of help boost the streaming services, help them get on their feet until they could pay a higher amount. So here comes the RIAA. They want 25 cents for every 100 plays.
Because they're saying you're billion-dollar businesses.
Right. You're a $3 billion businesses, and you're using this loophole to basically, you know, get all this music. And the Copyright Royalty Board said, well, not 14 cents, we'll make it 17 cents. So it's not 25 cents that the RIAA wanted. It's not the, you know, 14 cents Pandora wanted, although Pandora knew that its fees were going to increase this year. But it could have been much, much worse for Pandora. And everybody was assuming it was going to be much worse because as soon as this was announced, Pandora's stock price skyrocketed. So
is 17 cents keeping pace with inflation, or is that an actual raise in what they're paying?
They're saying it's not keeping pace with inflation, and that gets kind of complicated, but they're saying it's not. Pandora was very happy. They're looking at it as a win. They call it a balanced rate that we can work with and grow from. Whereas the RIAA and Sound Exchange is saying, quote, it's only fair that artists and record labels receive a market price when their music is used, to which many pirates said, okay, we were, you know, pirating it for free. Is that the market rate? Because without Pandora, that's kind of what we'd do. So there's your market rate.
So that's fascinating. They dodged a bullet. Does that affect the other streaming services?
Here's why that does not affect other streaming services. Until now, well, even now, Pandora does not have to go to the record companies and negotiate licenses.
Right? They just, because you buy a BMI or ASCAP license, you get a flat rate.
Correct. Compulsory license. However, when you are an on-demand service like Spotify or, well, used to be RDO or Apple Music, then you are an on-demand service and you have to negotiate with each record company individually.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the rub there.
So it does affect them in the sense that Pandora will remain a competitor with a great rate that they can't compete with.
Correct.
All right.
Well, and, you know, Pandora is really the only place where you can hear Adele's new album because they're pure play, they're radio, they're not on-demand streaming. So you can type in and create an Adele station, but you can't actually say, play Hello Again. You can't do that.
Right. You can't just listen to the album, but you can listen to songs and hear them whenever they pop up, just like on regular radio.
That's right.
And you can see her in concert. And guess what? Two friends of mine casually mentioned that they bought Adele tickets.
Oh, really?
I said, oh, how'd you do that? To Radio City Music Hall. She said, oh, I go, did you have like a phone and a laptop? And she's like, well, you know, I just went on the phone because it's quicker than the laptop, you know. So I just went on the phone and got the tickets. And, you know, the most expensive were only like $125 on the floor. So we got some on the floor near the front. I'm like, wow, I can't believe that. That's amazing. That's great. They had no problems whatsoever, but they did it within the first seconds that it went on sale and they got lucky.
Well, that is very lucky. I actually had like, you know, three windows going, and it was very frustrating because you'd be in these virtual waiting rooms. At least here in LA, it was done through AXS. So
yeah, she went online half an hour before, set it all up, you know, was all ready to go. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you would be in these virtual waiting rooms, and it was like, I was there for an hour and a half. And finally, at 45 minutes, they said, okay.
Sorry.
Yes. Hey, you can buy tickets now. I said, okay, 4 tickets. They said, yeah, we don't have that many. I said, okay, how about 3? They said, yeah, no, we don't have. I said, okay, 2. And I thought for sure, like, yeah, here in the bleachers. No. I said, okay, but how many tickets are there? So I picked 1 thinking, yeah, here's the stray seat that we, you know, somebody didn't buy. No tickets available.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, you knew that would happen. It's tens of millions of people wanting to see Adele. And only a couple 100,000 tickets available, even with all of North America put together, right?
That is true. And the thing that is happening here, so I, of course, went on to StubHub thinking, well, gee, they must all be listed at this point. There are very few tickets listed on StubHub. In fact, when you go to these secondary sites, some of them have little pop-ups that say, listen, we have a limited number of Adele tickets because of the way she's selling them. Now, Michael, the reason I wanted to bring this up is you kind of mentioned if Adele and or any artist wanted to limit the number of scalp tickets, they could easily do it by asking that you bring your ID and that the person who bought the ticket shows up with their credit card and their ID and walks into the
or assigns it to someone, or you got to bring the credit card or whatever.
Right.
But people say this is just not possible, right?
Well, believe it or not, that's what they're doing, at least here in Los Angeles. You have 2 ways of purchasing the ticket. You never get a ticket. Okay. So if there was no...
Exactly. You got to go there and pick it up.
Well, no. Here's the thing. First off, in LA, you couldn't call in to buy a ticket. So that was right off the table. Number two, if you purchased online, not through the Adele fan club, okay, so not directly from Adele, and there were only 8% of the seats available, roughly, to the fan club.
Right.
You do not get a ticket if you buy through AEG, if you bought through the Staples Center, effectively.
So you can't hand it over to anyone.
You can't hand it over. The only ticket you have is your credit card. So you have to show up with your credit card, and that credit card becomes your ticket.
Interesting.
For fan club members, so, you know, a lot of these secondary markets will go become members of the fan club and then like buy a whole bunch of tickets that way. You actually don't get a ticket until you show up at the venue with your credit card, and you can't leave the venue upon receiving your ticket at will call. You get the ticket, and if you bought 4 tickets, all 4 people have to walk in at the same time. You can't say, well, I just got to go hand this one to my friend outside. He's in the park. Nope, sorry.
Well, that's a lot of hassle, and it's a great new normal, and I hope that other people do it and it becomes, you know, standard issue, and that's the way to do it. I hadn't heard that she was doing that. My friends are also members, big fans of Pearl Jam and U2, and they're in the Pearl Jam fan club and the U2 fan club, and that's all the stuff they do for their fans too, to make sure that they get to help their fans and make sure nobody's reselling them. So they jump through a little hoops to make sure that those fans can get in, but also make sure that there's not somebody there just doing it to resell. So good for her.
Well, yeah, and she worked with a company called Songkick, which is it's a site that specializes in kind of like artist fan club, you know, concert going. They manage tickets and notices and marketing for lots of music artists. They sold for the European tour in Britain 235,000 tickets through her website, Adele.com, and they say they blocked about 53,000 ticket sales to known or likely scalpers. You know, how true that is, I don't know. I do know this. It is becoming an issue that others are looking at, including the Attorney General of New York, the state of New York, Michael, has said, you know, it's funny, but tickets aren't on sale yet, and I can go and buy a ticket to see Adele already. How is that possible that I can buy a ticket to see Bruce Springsteen when tickets haven't even been sold yet? That means you have speculative listings, meaning the person who is selling you the ticket doesn't even have the ticket, which is against the law. You can't do that. You have to have ticket in hand before you offer it. This is, Michael, we've talked about this in the past.
But it looks like Adele is, you know, doing the thing that the stuff that you do if you really want to stop it.
Yes. And here's what I think happened, because you have people like Elton John and Noel Gallagher and the Mumford and Sons beginning to look at this. What happened years ago, and I'm going to make this really quick, Michael, but years ago, artists didn't want to seem like pigs. So
they would quietly sell stuff on the other outside market for huge prices, but they didn't want to put that number on their ticket.
Right. So they said, okay, sell 25% of the tickets to the secondary market and we'll get the $500 instead of the scalpers.
Right. Well, or they say, let's do a lavish thing where you book, you know, a hotel and a thing and a backstage pass and we'll charge $10,000 for that, but nobody will mind.
Right.
You know, do all sorts of things.
Precisely. So now what wound up happening is all these promoters started doing that for all of their shows. Even artists that didn't know that it was happening
Yeah.
25% of the ticket, because they don't really care. They get what's called a minimum guarantee. So they come, they play, whether it's sold out or not, they get usually now between 100 and 125% of the ticket sales.
That's like you have an article about Taylor Swift about a particular show. This is in Tampa Bay, Florida.
Yes.
And because it's a public stadium or publicly owned, the facts are available. She got 100% of the ticket sales. Like the stadium got nothing.
Well, no, that's the thing. You'd say, well,
no, why? I mean, they got nothing from ticket sales. She got 100%. It was about $4 million in ticket sales. She got it all.
That's right. And because she's the promoter, you know, her company promotes the show. She, of course, has to turn around and pay the promoter. Okay. So while
she pays herself,
she's paying herself. So that minimum guarantee for her, and this is why tickets are so expensive these days, a minimum guarantee, $2.75 million. That is called a PA fee, a personal appearance fee. And that is incredibly expensive. But she is the hottest.
Well, that's about
going.
$40 average per ticket. That's not that much. $50. That's $50 a ticket because there's 57,000 tickets to be sold there. So 2.75 million would say you could sell all those tickets for $50 and get to 2.75 million. You know, so if she wanted to keep it cheaper, she could. It's the artist's choice all up and down the line. You know, you see Pearl Jam and Garth Brooks and other people fighting to keep low ticket prices. Everybody can do that if they want to. But that's where they make their money now, so that's where they're going to make their money. But it's nice to at least to try to prevent scalping, because then they don't make the money and the fans are angry.
Well, and I think, like I said, what's happening is promoters got greedy and they started...
Artists got greedy and promoters, everybody got greedy.
But I think really what happened is it was one thing when you were doing it for like big acts and you knew that you could get more for, let's say, a Led Zeppelin reunion, but Led Zeppelin didn't want to, you know, seem like they were greedy. It's another thing when you're doing it for literally every single act that comes into the arena and like 90%, of, not 90%, but a large majority of the tickets are already on secondary.
And it happens on Broadway as well. I mean, you know.
Absolutely. And so I think by having it, you know, look, I can't remember the saying, but it ends up with pigs get slaughtered, you know, and I think in this case, you know, it's that old Wall Street saying.
Okay.
Oh, bulls and bears make money, pigs get slaughtered, something like that. I think in this case, the promoters kind of are getting caught up in it.
Well, but the promoters aren't going to be screwed here. It'll be the scalpers, the third party people that they're hopefully going to eliminate from this.
Yeah, because you know what? The promoters are still the promoters. They're still going to make their money. They won't make as much, but they'll still make money selling tickets.
That's right. And of course, that brings us to, that's the death of Inside Baseball, which brings us to obituaries, a little sad music comment. Scott Weiland, former singer of the Stone Temple Pilots, the autopsy came out. In fact, his death was drug related, sadly. He OD'd on a mixture of cocaine, ethanol, and MDA. So the demons that haunted him his entire life did in fact haunt him right up to the end. So it's sad news, but you should read his ex-wife's commentary in Rolling Stone, which I thought was very respectful to him, but very pointed about how you can celebrate his life by trying to do good for some kid somewhere.
Yeah, well, we still haven't answered how I'm going to get Adele tickets. So,
I said my friends are seeing Adele, so, you know, I'll just be really nice to them, and then maybe they'll let me go with them.
Okay, well, you know, by the way, Michael, and this is a bit of an aside, although we were just doing obituaries, so do you want to mention Kurt Mazur?
Oh, he died?
He passed away on Sunday.
Oh, I did not see
Saturday.
That. I was traveling.
Yeah.
Wow.
And okay. I'll put a link in the show notes to the New York Times obituary for him. He was the, he was a conductor and a musical director. He was the conductor for the New York Philharmonic after Zubin Mehta from 1991 to 2002. He's credited with turning that orchestra around and really kind of reviving it. And what's interesting about his obituary is it really explains a lot about 20th century classical music, especially in Europe, and how he was from East Germany. And it's a fascinating read.
Why they're such a source for great conductors. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really well worth reading. Even if you don't know him or if you care at all about music, read it.
Well, I'll be sure to check that out.
Yeah, but that does wrap up this week's show, and in fact, this year's shows. I mean, we're not going to do another one this year, right?
That's why this one was 4 hours long.
That's right. Now, hold on, I'm going to play that Obama clip again.
No, please don't.
Okay. Michael, by the way, in case you're wondering, does not like it when I play clips.
Nope.
He said something about that we've turned our show into a morning zoo show. to which I said, there are no animals, so I don't understand.
Keep going.
Okay. Okay, well, hey, we mentioned it at the top of the show. We're going to mention it again. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show, and we do love it when you rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators and when you subscribe. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can like us on Facebook. Our Facebook page is Showbiz Sandbox, of course. And you can follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Much like us, we have a website, showbizsandbox.com. MGMT has their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. No question mark, though. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Michael, Rosie, take me to Adele.com.
Or if you can't find any of Michael's writing and coverage of the entertainment industry there, head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can head to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next year, play nice.